loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we continue our regular segment on the militarization of space. Today, we focus on the major role played by former Nazi officials who were transferred to the United States following the end of World War II and played central roles in the development of the U.S. space program. And then we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort was in court for sentencing today. Manafort was found guilty of several crimes relating to financial fraud. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave a press conference today to address the growing scandal engulfing his administration over his alleged efforts to assist engineering giant SNC-Lavalin. Trudeau is accused of inappropriately pressuring the former attorney general to defer a criminal prosecution of the firm for bribery. At today's press conference, Trudeau admitted that he had, quote, made mistakes, but denied any illegality. Chinese telecommunications corporation Huawei filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government today in the district court in Plano, Texas, where the company has a headquarters. Huawei is challenging the new federal policy prohibiting government agencies and contractors from using its products. The lawsuit alleges that the policy violates the company's right to due process. A car bombing took place in the Somali capital Mogadishu today, killing at least seven. The explosion occurred outside a restaurant near a presidential guard checkpoint. The country is in the midst of a long-running insurgency, principally conducted by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Those are today's headlines. You are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Today we continue our weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? We're joined from Old Westbury, New York by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of six books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. And we're joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Bruce, let's start with you. One of the things that we've talked about on this show in this segment in previous weeks is the role, this is going to sound crazy to Americans who don't know their history, but the role of Nazis in the development of the U.S. space program, and not just the space program, but the missile program as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I learned about this early on from an incredible book called Secret Agenda by Linda Hunt, a former CNN reporter, where she tells the entire story about the U.S. secret program called Operation Paperclip that after World War II, 1,500 of the top Nazi military operatives were smuggled into the United States. Even the President of the United States wasn't aware of it at the time. That it happened. And amongst these 1,500 Nazi operatives were former head of Nazi intelligence that were brought to help create the CIA. But also, there were 100 of the Nazi rocket scientists, Wernher von Braun and his engineer team. And they brought along with them 100 copies of the V-2 rocket brought to Huntsville, Alabama, where they created the U.S. space program. And among them was a guy by the name of Major General Walter Dornberger. And Dornberger was the liaison between Hitler and the Nazi rocket team. His job was to oversee the operation. He became vice president of Bell Aerospace in New York.
Wow.
And went on to speak to the Congress of the United States some years later, outlining a proposal to put orbiting battle stations in space. So what we're seeing today, I believe, is the fulfillment of this Nazi prophecy.
Yeah, Operation Paperclip was one of the largest, the broadest, the most extensive early operations in the history of the CIA. It actually began before the CIA was created, and it was run by the OSS. Some of these Nazi scientists later told journalists that as Germany was falling apart in the spring of 1945, they gathered together and they said, so what do we do? Do we give ourselves up to the Russians or to the Americans? And they unanimously decided to give themselves up to the Americans. Now, some of them had been Nazi Party leaders, not just members of the Nazi Party, but actual leaders of the Nazi Party. And they remained in Germany in hiding. Some of them got to Austria. Some of them got to Switzerland and came to the United States later, because this Operation Paperclip dragged on all the way to 1959. You're exactly right that scientists like Wernher von Braun and his entire V-2 rocket team found their way to the United States through this program. President Truman didn't even know that we had this program. And they're the guys that ended up designing American missiles in the 1950s through the 1950s, and then rockets in the 1960s that finally enabled us to go to the moon.
And it's important to know that before, during the war, when they were building these rockets, they did it at a concentration camp called Dora, where camp inmates were starved, beaten, hanged, and literally worked to death as slaves inside a mountain tunnel that they called Middlework. And when the Americans' army liberated this place, they found 6,000 bodies covering the ground, and come to find out well over 20,000 of these slaves at Middlework were killed at the hands of these Nazis. And in fact, I've read in various accounts that Wernher von Braun at one time pled with the Nazi operation, the Nazi hierarchy, to send more slaves there so they could speed up the operation. So these are the people that were brought to this country.
This wasn't a secret that von Braun was a Nazi, and it wasn't a secret that he had entered a senior position in the U.S. government at NASA. What was the public reaction when people found out that we had Wernher von Braun on the taxpayers' payroll?
He was celebrated. Wernher von Braun, in fact, there's a little museum down there in Huntsville, Alabama, celebrating Wernher von Braun. I mean, this whole hideous history,
it's incredible,
is really unknown. And I must fault my profession, the press, the media, not really digging it up then, or in fact, digging it up now. I mean, Linda Hunt and Bruce and I have met Linda, a great journalist, and she's done this work in books. A very important author too on this phase of a very dark side of American history. Jack Mano, he was a professor, now emeritus, at the Environmental Science and Forestry College, part of the State University of New York. Let me just read, this is from my book, Weapons in Space, in which I quote Jack Mano's book, Arming the Heavens. Quote, in 1947, Major General Walter Dornberger, again, this big Nazi military space figure, as a consultant to the U.S. Air Force, an advisor to the Department of Defense, wrote a planning paper for his new employees. He projected a system of hundreds of nuclear-armed satellites, all orbiting at different altitudes and angles, each capable of re-entering the atmosphere on command from Earth to proceed to its target. The Air Force began early work on Dornberger's idea under the acronym NABS, Nuclear Armed Bombardment Satellites. As a variation on NABS, Dornberger also proposed, and it goes on and on in Jack Mano's book, and I include it because it's so important in my book. And now many years later, and we're talking about 70 years later, we see this push by the Trump administration for a space force and weaponry in space. And of course, Reagan's Star Wars was all about that too. But the history goes back to this post-World War II era, and Project Paperclip and the Nazi scientists being in the middle of American space military policy and actions.
Yeah, you know, they were celebrated in their time, especially the 1950s and 1960s. I just found something online I want to read to you. It's fascinating to me. A whole host of these Nazi scientists, Kurt Debus, Eberhard Reiss, Arthur Rudolph, Wernher von Braun, Ernst Geissler, a whole bunch of them, they won the NASA Distinguished Service Medal, which is the highest award that can be bestowed by NASA. They won the Department of Defense Distinguished Civilian Service Award, which is the highest civilian service award given by the Department of Defense. They won the Goddard Astronautics Award, highest honor bestowed in the field of astronautics. I'm not sure what that is. They were elected to the U.S. Space Camp Hall of Fame in Huntsville, Alabama. They were elected to the New Mexico Museum of Space History Hall of Fame.
Wait a second. Does the N in NASA stand for Nazi? Or?
It might as well. And then this is the funniest one. They all had craters named after them on the moon.
Oh, God. Well, you know.
Nazi craters brought to you by American taxpayers.
The Global Network has organized a couple conferences and protests in Huntsville over the years. And when we've gone there, people in the community don't really want to talk about these Nazis. They call them the Germans. And what they say is that these Germans actually brought culture to Huntsville, Alabama.
Boy.
The opera, the ballet, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, they were the master race. I mean, of course they'd bring...
They also made the trains run on time.
That was Mussolini.
Oh, that's right. That was the Italians.
Well, and let me add also from Arming the Heavens. Again, this is in my book. My book is titled Weapons in Space. The Nazi scientists are an important historical and technical link, and also an ideological link. Those are Mano's words. He goes on as to the claim of space warfare being defensive. How Reagan characterized his Star Wars plan as a shield to the Appalachian missile defense today, and this is Mano, quote, it's all a smokescreen. The aim is to put all the pieces together and have the capacity to carry out global warfare, including weapons systems that reside in space. I mean, and here we are with Trump, worse than ever. In terms of the weaponization of the heavens, making space into a war zone.
Let's keep on this topic of NASA, too. NASA is going back to nuclear rockets. That's something that they haven't done in a while. Tell us a little bit about that. Bruce, you want to start?
Well, you know, for many, many years, they were working on a thing they called the Death Star, an orbiting laser-powered battle station that would be powered with nuclear reactors. So for a long, long time, the Pentagon has said that they would require ultimately nuclear power in space, nuclear reactors, to generate the kind of force for weaponry in space. So this has been something they've been working on and developing for many, 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 many years.
And it's not just nuclear, which is horrible enough, nuclear reactors up there above our heads in space on these battle platforms. The scheme has been for years to have nuclear-powered rockets delivering all kind of stuff up to these battle platforms. And they would be, in fact, there was one called Timberwind. This is a few years ago, a nuclear-powered rocket servicing the weapons system in space. And here, let me read, and again, today we're going backwards. In fact, the headline, this is just a few days ago, March 2nd, from The Hill, publication out of Washington, mm-hmm. NASA is going back to the future with nuclear rockets. And the lead, the first line of the story, is tucked into the recent spending bill that was passed by Congress, is a line item for $100 million for NASA to develop a nuclear thermal rocket. And there's another piece. This is in Forbes magazine, Nuclear in Space, the NETS meeting. And what NETS stands for is Nuclear and Emerging Technologies for Space. And this is also a recent piece. This is February 28th. about an annual gathering of people from NASA, national laboratories, and so forth, pushing for nuclear-powered rockets in space. And it's all tied up, and there's never been any kind of, NASA was created ostensibly as a civilian entity in 1958, but it's never been just a civilian entity. It works hand in hand with the U.S. military. Many of the NASA missions are called dual-use, dual-purpose missions, where certain military requirements are met, along with, but this is often a cover, civilian purposes.
One of the visions of this conference that Carl just referred to that was held in Washington State last month, where the industry, NASA, nuclear industry, NASA, and others came together. They've been holding these conferences annually for many years. I've been to some of them and protested outside of many of them. And they're also talking about nuclear-powered mining colonies on the moon and Mars and various asteroids for mining for rare minerals and resources. And so just imagine a succession of launches of nuclear devices on rockets that have a 10% failure rate from a place like Cape Canaveral. In 1997, NASA launched the Cassini mission with 72 pounds of plutonium-238 on it. And we ran an international campaign for 3 years before that, opposing that launch. And in the environmental impact statement for that particular launch, NASA admitted that if there was a launch explosion and a release of the plutonium as dust, it would be carried by the winds for a 60-mile radius in Florida. So from Cape Canaveral westward to Disney World, north to Daytona Beach and south to Vero Beach, Florida, and they said that whole area would be radiated, and they would have to go in and remove all the people. They would have to go in and remove all the buildings. They'd have to go in and remove all the vegetation, the animals, imagine that, and then the top half inch of soil, because everything, again, would be radioactive for thousands of years. And just before that launch, Los Alamos, it was reported in a newspaper in New Mexico that Los Alamos Department of Energy Laboratory, they had 244 cases of worker contamination as they were fabricating the generators for that Cassini mission. And so DOE has a long history of water and air pollution with radioactive sources. So these missions are actually killing people, these space nuclear missions, even before they're launched.
I want to just ask a follow-up question about that. I mean, given the risk, the catastrophic risk, again, if there was an explosion, 60 square miles of radiation and having to remove all the people, having to remove property, a lot of people dying, what's the justification? I mean, their justification for having such attendant risk in terms of cost-benefit analysis, is it just as simple like mistakes won't happen, accidents won't happen, and thus we don't have to sweat it?
Well, it's all kind of wishful thinking to the extreme, and also deceit. For example, I'm looking here at the Forbes story. Solar energy does not work much beyond Mars. That's not true. In fact, it was the Juno space probe, which reached a planet called Jupiter in 2016, 3 years ago, and instead of using nuclear onboard power, it had solar power, solar panels. So if we want to explore space, we can do it safely and not endanger a life on Earth. And if I could just jump back to the Cassini protests, let me jump to the Hill article now about this going back to the future with nuclear rockets. And here's a big chunk of words very much reflecting on the great work of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. It says, NASA would be advised to prepare for protests from the anti-nuclear movement when it launches its flight demonstration of a nuclear thermal rocket, similar to the ones that accompanied the launch of the Cassini probe to Saturn, powered by nuclear-fueled RTGs. And this is what Bruce is talking about in 1997. And then it goes on about safety studies. Here we're talking here about wishful thinking and deceit to ensure the space agency will, of course, conduct safety studies to ensure that the risk of a launch accident is as low as possible. But such studies likely will not deter protest demonstrators or even lawsuits. But they will answer any objections that anti-nuclear activists will offer. They will not, in fact, answer any objections. We're being pushed. We're talking about global disaster. In the environmental impact statement for the Cassini mission, it talks about there was a flyby involved with the Cassini probe, and it's 75 pounds of plutonium were to be sent back at Earth to increase its velocity. And if it missed, the trajectory was off and it hit the atmosphere and that plutonium was dispersed, that EES talks about 5 billion of the Earth's 8 billion inhabitants at the time receiving radiation exposure. I mean, the scale of destruction here is so immense. It's also unnecessary, and again, very, very much tied into weaponizing space, turning the heavens into a war zone.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, I was just going to say that we were one of our successes on that Cassini campaign was when they did the flyby. They moved it several hundred miles farther away from the Earth as it swung around the Earth to gain momentum to go out into deep space. So we forced them essentially to change the trajectory of the flyby and move it further away from the Earth, lowering the possibility of a dramatic reentry into Earth orbit and burning up and spreading the plutonium. There have been a number of failures over the years of these kind of space nuclear missions where they burned up on reentry, fell back to Earth, burned up on reentry, and spread plutonium and uranium globally. And Dr. John Goffman, one of the founders of uranium, studied a particular accident in 1964 called SNAP-9A, a U.S. military satellite with 2 pounds of plutonium. And he said he believes it's one of the major reasons for the increases of cancer on the Earth today.
That's amazing. I'm looking at the something called solarsystem.nasa.gov. So this is a government publication about the Cassini project. I want to read a couple sentences just so our broader audience that may not be paying that much attention to it, one, has a little bit more of an understanding and also a little bit better sense of the propaganda coming from the U.S. government about it. Here's what it says. For more than a decade, NASA's Cassini spacecraft shared the wonders of Saturn and its family of icy moons, taking us to astounding worlds where methane rivers run to a methane sea, and where jets of ice and gas are blasting material into space from a liquid water ocean that might harbor the ingredients for life. Cassini revealed in great detail the true wonders of Saturn, a giant world ruled by raging storms and delicate harmonies of gravity. Cassini carried a passenger to the Saturn system, the European Huygens probe, the first human-made object to land on a world in the distant outer solar system. And then here's the last paragraph. After 20 years in space, 13 of those years exploring Saturn, Cassini exhausted its fuel supply, and so to protect moons of Saturn that could have conditions suitable for life, Cassini was sent on a daring final mission that would seal its fate. After a series of nearly 24 nail-biting dives between the planet and its icy rings, Cassini plunged into Saturn's atmosphere on September 15, 2017, returning science data to the very end. I want to ask both of you, it sounds wonderful, it sounds daring, it also sounds entirely benign, as if these daring missions that finally ended up plunging into Saturn's atmosphere was more or less risk-free.
Well, it certainly not risk-free from the get-go, from the launch. And also, here is NASA presuming that there is no life. It would be a strange form of life. No life where it's sending Cassini crashing. It's so completely irresponsible. Years ago, they used to sterilize, as I understand it, the U.S. did, stuff that they were sending up into space so that we wouldn't contaminate other heavenly bodies. But to save money, again, this is what I've been told, that has stopped. So here we are, not only endangering life on Earth, but threatening any life that might exist where we're sending these nuclear-powered systems.
Right. Go ahead, Bruce. It sounds, I mean, when I read that, that was the first thing that came to my mind as well. I mean, they're crashing this stuff into Saturn.
Well, you might remember from the old television series Star Trek, the original, they had a prime directive that they often talked about on almost every show as they went off into space. Came in contact with other life forms or other places where there might be life. And the prime directive was do no harm. And so from the very outset, from the very planning stages, when they sit down to at the NASA to make a decision on what kind of power source are they going to use on a particular mission, what we've learned over the years is that the nuclear industry occupies most of the seats on the planning committee. And so the industry views space as a new market. They're desperate to move nuclear power into space. They just see so many possibilities and opportunities for profit. And so they've taken control of all the decision-making processes so that when they could use solar, they don't. They say it won't work. We have to use nuclear. And so they've forced their way. They've broken through and controlled the process to the point where they're now risking the lives of everybody on this planet and possibly risking other life forms in other places that where they deposit these nuclear devices in the future.
We have about 2 minutes left, John. And Bruce and Carl, where do you want to end? What's our last big story here?
I want to say something about Reinhard Gehlen, also part of this Operation Paperclip. Yeah. I think this is one of the biggest stories of all. During the war, Major General Reinhard Gehlen served as Hitler's intelligence chief on the Eastern Front. His foreign army's East apparatus relentlessly probed for weaknesses in the Soviet defenses as the Nazi juggernaut made its eastward thrust. He pointed out the location of Jews, communists, and other enemies of the Third Reich. They were ultimately overrun by Hitler forces so they could be rounded up and executed by death squads. Gehlen was brought to the U.S. under Operation Paperclip. He was introduced to Alan Dulles. They helped create the CIA together. And then in 1955, he was sent back to the new country, West Germany, the divided Germany, after the post-World War II era. So in 1955, he was transferred to the West German government, where he became the head of intelligence for West Germany. So here the U.S. planted one of the top Nazi operatives, intelligence operatives, a known criminal, a known killer, should have been at the Nuremberg war crimes for all that he did. He was deposited in the place in West Germany as the new head of intelligence for West Germany. It tells you a lot about what came as after the creation of the West German government, Operation Gladio, where the U.S. and NATO were using these Nazi operatives to interfere in Italian elections and make sure communists wouldn't be elected, and other such moves throughout Europe in the post-World War II era. It's a dirty, dirty story, Operation Paperclip. More people should know about it.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Right.
And again, I don't think we should be naming airports or bridges or tunnels after people who were admirers of the Nazis. And we're here in Washington, D.C., Dulles Airport, named after John Foster Dulles. Dulles, John Foster and Alan Dulles, who became the head of the CIA, John Foster was Secretary of State, they admired Hitler before the war. Once the war started, they had to kind of cool it. But anyway, extremely important history, basically unknown history, John. I want to thank both of our guests for that.
We were very pleased to have both Carl Grossman and Bruce Gagnon. We were joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. And we were joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and he's a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shatterproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Welcome back, Kev.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kevin, one of the issues that we've discussed at length on this program is the issue of private prisons and the conditions in these prisons, whether it's medical care or food or a higher suicide rate among both prisoners and guards. Tell us a little bit about this decision this past week that JP Morgan took.
Yeah. So this is the product of grassroots activism. Let us be clear that JP Morgan Chase did not have its, you know, so-called come to Jesus moment and decide that it wanted to do right by human beings. It was making money, lending to the Geo Group, lending to CoreCivic, lending to these big private prison contractors, many of them who have been profiting greatly off of jailing immigrants in the past few years here. And in fact, I think around 75% of immigrants in ICE custody are actually in privately run facilities. And so there are activists, you know, one of them, just to quote from Make the Road New York, that have been doing marches to the JP Morgan Chase Bank in New York City, celebrating, saying, you know, we've been doing these marches and we'll continue to work for this to put the private prison industry out of business as we fight for respect and dignity for every member of our community. And so, I mean, this is really, I think, a huge step, because when the money leaves, when you don't have investment, when you don't have people who are willing to advance lines of credit so that you can have these private prisons and finance and operate them, build them too, as they might want to expand and have more facilities available for detaining immigrants and also to incarcerate other individuals, because there'd be the potential for that as well, then you're really putting them in dire straits and potentially forcing them out of business. And that's really where they were. Let's be clear. A couple years ago, you know, 2 to 3 years ago, the federal government was in the process of entirely phasing out federal private prisons.
Yeah.
And that was going to be a huge disaster for CoreCivic and Geo Group. And Donald Trump has the administration, through very sympathetic Justice Department officials, as we've talked about with Jeff Sessions, did a whole 180, basically reviving and reviving the entire prospects for both of these companies, these major companies, to profit. And then now I think this is going to be a huge deal, because as JP Morgan goes, what happens to other bank competitors? I mean, you'd think that they could just go to another bank, but it also could be the case that JP Morgan sets a standard that other banks will want to follow.
I want to echo your comments here, because this isn't just, you know, John and Kevin decided to sell their Geo stock. This is a major move by one of the biggest banks in the world. The stock prices of private prison corporations went up when Donald Trump was elected president, especially when he named Jeff Sessions as the attorney general, because these companies thought, rightly so far, that the environment is going to be good for them. They're going to be able to expand their hold on the prison industry. The fact that JP Morgan has decided to get out of this space is a major setback for them. And you know that once this hit the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, you know that the rest of the big banks on Wall Street perked their ears up and had to have a conversation in their executive suites. Do we do the same thing? This is a very big deal. I hope something comes of it besides just with JP Morgan.
Yeah, from the financial standpoint, I do think, to go back to what you were saying about stock prices, the Geo Group stock was hit by a 8.5% loss over 2 days. That's actually really considerable consider
that's huge.
Any stock. So yeah, people are taking this seriously. They believe that this might signal a big direction in the way in which private prisons are able to operate.
Absolutely right. You and I had a conversation off the air as well about prison labor. There's a lot to talk about today regarding prison labor, but you had some background you wanted to tell us.
What I was referring to is along the lines of this whole issue of profiting off of prisons is that there's this report that's out from the Vera Institute of Justice, and it points to how states are having county facilities hold prisoners and pretrial detainees, and then they're making payments to these county facilities in order to deal with overcrowding in their prisons, and that in fact these rural jails in Kentucky are relying on this income that is derived from payments for holding these state prisoners in county facilities. I think that's a huge issue for us to just grapple with, because as we're talking about criminal justice reform and the different shapes it might take, there's an incentive for these states because they're actually balancing their budgets by, well, not just states, but these counties are actually balancing their budgets by holding these state prisoners. And so rather than releasing prisoners, what you have is the state shuffling these prisoners to other facilities. And again, I was reminded of just a whistleblower case we've talked about on our show of Reality Winner, because when she was going through these transfer centers and moved somewhat similarly, although it's more about how the federal government actually shuffles federal prisoners to state jails so that they can make space for people as they're moving them around the country. But this happens between the different levels of government as far as prisons, that between with federal prisoners being sent to state facilities so that federal prisons can make space, with state prisons sending them to county facilities so that state prisons can make space. And that's how we're dealing with overcrowding rather than just reducing the incarceration population.
You know, one of the things that I learned too when I was in prison is that you can't sue the Bureau of Prisons or the Justice Department until you first go through what's called the administrative process. So you have to fill out a form called a BP 8.5, and that is a complaint that goes to the warden. The warden then denies your complaint. Then you fill out a form called a BP 9 that goes to the regional director of the Bureau of Prisons. He'll deny you because they always do. You fill out a BP 10, which goes to the larger region director, and then he'll deny you. And then you fill out a BP 11, which goes to the head of the Bureau of Prisons, and then you're denied. Well, that normally takes about a year to work its way through the system. And only then are you allowed to file a suit against the Bureau of Prisons. But what they do, as you just said a moment ago, is if you have an actual case, they'll just move you to a state prison or to a transportation facility or to another federal prison, and you have to start the entire process all over again. That way, if you do file suit, you don't have standing and your point is moot and they dismiss your case with prejudice. So they have all these things figured out. They know exactly how they can get away with this stuff and not have people complain, especially through the judicial branch.
And that's a big, important point to make as well. I also want to just bring up here that the economic component of the fact that these counties are trying to fill a gap. So the Vera Institute points to how you've seen the decline of the coal industry. So in particular in Kentucky, they have actually the 9th highest rate of incarceration in the country. In fact, I saw something from the Vera Institute that says if Kentucky continues at the rate that it's going right now, in a little more than 100 years, the entire state would be in prison. And so what they're doing, though, is because they've lost revenue from coal excise taxes, different things that were out there, they're replacing it with money from incarcerating people. So and they're pointing out this because it's important, because what you're having is you used to have a society that was organized around the coal industry. And now, as that has gone away, you're organizing around prisons. And we've talked about prison towns, and we've talked about states that really rely on incarcerating people. Florida, as Paul has talked about, heavy on their reliance of jailing people. And so I think it's crucial to get ahead of it before it becomes solidified, because as activists that might want to impact and reform, it becomes really difficult when the profits are there and everyone depending on the money in order to get by, to survive. That's how the state is trying to survive, is by feeding off of the prisons.
And that happens every day in America. I want to switch topics too. We've talked a lot on the show about the death penalty and about execution by lethal injection. You flagged a piece for us in the Associated Press from a couple of days ago. It's entitled, "Arkansas Bill Would Expand Execution Drug Secrecy Law." And what it says here is that the state of Arkansas is proposing a new law that would make it a felony to identify the supply and the type of execution drugs that are used. Now, can you imagine such a thing? It would make it a felony. You would go to jail, go to prison, actually, not even jail, if you say in public what drugs the state of Arkansas used to execute someone. What do you think of this?
Well, I think it just shows how desperate they are to protect the death penalty from abolition. I mean, they know that the trend is going in that direction, and so they have to take this kind of extreme action in order to protect it. But, you know, on the matter itself, without being general, what does it mean for me as a journalist? I mean, are you saying, because it's not clear here, are you saying that if I obtain information about execution drug supplies and I'm a journalist in Arkansas,
right,
because this would be a state law, do I face a penalty where I could become a felon because I published information about the execution drugs? I think this is a huge attack on journalists in Arkansas. And I think to the extent that it would be adopted by the state government, I would be really surprised if it survived any challenge in the courts. I know that there are probably groups just waiting to file the suits against this for violating, you know, the First Amendment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, honestly, the lobbyists for the death penalty industry, for lack of a better term, should be accused of abusing and wasting taxpayer money, because there's no way that this can survive. So what they're doing is really just trying to put fear in journalists to back off and not cover what goes on with these drugs, because we've talked about them on this show, the way in which people are essentially the executioners that are carrying out this are experimenting with the drugs. They don't know exactly
That's
the effects
right.
on the inmates on death row that are being executed. And at the time that they happen, you don't actually know that the people are going to die from them. In some cases, we've had horrible experiences that have been described in news reports of it taking hours for that person to die and breathe their last breath of air. And it's torture. And so, you know, in some cases, it's actually contributed and helped to discouraging states from pursuing the death penalty more. And so I think that this is a really an effort to lash out at people who have fought against the death penalty.
I think you're right. I want to read just a couple of sentences from this Associated Press article. It says the proposal would prohibit the state from releasing documents or information that identify or could indirectly identify the suppliers and makers of its execution drugs. The proposal would make, quote, recklessly, unquote, disclosing the information a felony. This Republican state senator, Bart Hester, who's sponsoring this bill, says this bill will protect those who want to help us uphold the law and help protect the people of Arkansas, which makes no sense to me. Goes on to say that Arkansas was sued in 2017 after it refused to release the labels and inserts on the boxes or from the boxes which these drugs were contained. The Associated Press has previously used the labels with the manufacturer's name blacked out by the state to identify drug makers whose products were used in the executions. The state Supreme Court has allowed the state to redact other information from the labels, such as the lot and batch numbers of the drug. The state of Arkansas really does not want people to know what they're doing and what they're using to execute people because, well, it's for the reason that you cited. They're afraid that people are going to come to the realization that this is cruel and unusual. It's intensely painful. It's a kind of torture, and it's eventually going to be overturned, and they're not going to be allowed to do it anymore.
Yeah, and what you read there is important for people. It ties back to what we were saying about JP Morgan. They don't want the people to create a cost for the pharmaceutical companies that are providing the drugs and decide not to provide them anymore. So the state is promising them secrecy so that the public doesn't know which pharmaceutical companies are giving them these drugs. And if they don't know, then their stock prices can't be impacted by activists who decide that they oppose the state using these pharmaceutical drugs to execute prisoners.
Yeah.
And then there's also, we mentioned journalists, let's be clear and mention the whistleblower issue here, because if you have people internally who are working that they see something that's abusive, they, and even if they agree with the use of the drug, but they say that they are improperly blending these cocktails and they mm-hmm. don't know what they're doing mm-hmm. and they're inept. Even if they just said, look, I support the death penalty, but I think what they're doing is inept. They don't know what they're doing. They're stupid and they released information. They could be accused of recklessly disclosing corruption. And they might actually be death penalty supporters. So you would be punishing somebody who was trying to make the state more efficient. You know, but again, I think what they're most concerned about is that it would lead to the abolition of the death penalty.
Absolutely right. Let's move on to another topic. And this is a lawsuit filed in Alameda County, California, by female prisoners suing for the right to sleep. Can you explain that?
At least when I look at the report, it seems new to me. Like they might be trying to blaze some new ground here
right.
on behalf of prisoners' rights to say that during the nighttime, you should not come to the cell at 3 a.m. in the morning, bang on it, wake me up and do a spot check and try to see if I'm well and everything's okay. And in fact, by you coming to my cell to do that, you're actually trying to deprive me of sleep, and it is cruel and unusual punishment. And they think that there's a U.S. district judge there who might be sympathetic to this case, and that's part of why I think their attorneys are pursuing it. And it's on behalf of women, incarcerated women who are having trouble sleeping in the nighttime and they feel that they're being punished.
I can tell you that it's literally impossible to sleep a full night in prison. Prisons are loud places to begin with, but then at least twice during the night, usually three times during the night, the guards go from cell to cell to cell, flashing a ridiculously bright, like military-grade flashlight in your face, keys jingling, banging on your locker, pretending to count. They're really just trying to wake you up and disturb you. And that's just daily life in prison. You're right that this judge seems to be a sympathetic ear. This is U.S. District Court Judge James Donato, who it says here signaled willingness on Thursday, today, to question the status quo. So these prisoners may get a fair hearing. This article starts off, it's such a cool way to start this off. It says here, when prisoners entered Alcatraz in the mid-1900s, they were handed a booklet that included an exhaustive list of their rights behind bars. This is it. You are entitled to food, clothing, shelter, and medical attention. Anything else that you get is a privilege. Well, sleep apparently is a privilege. There was one guard who was particularly nasty when I was in prison. And when he was on the midnight shift, he would take a wooden mallet and he would bang as hard as he could on all of the bars of the door that sealed off our housing unit. He said he did it just to make sure nobody had filed through the bars. Now, mind you, this is inside the centermost part of the prison. Even if there was no door there, it wouldn't have made one whit of difference. But he did it just so people couldn't sleep all night long. And it turns out that that's the rule, not the exception.
Yeah, and what sticks out to me about what is described and in relation to what you're saying there is these examples of behavior. You know, in the sense that, like, it's to some degree they're upset that there's things happening in the night, like vacuuming and repairs that are probably going to happen in any facility during the nighttime.
Sure.
And so it'd be really difficult to say that you're going to prohibit that because maybe during the daytime they can't get into certain spaces. Who knows? But beaming into prisoners' eyes, flashlights, guards yelling their names at them, banging on the metal doors with keys. These are examples of things that they say are depriving them of sleep. And what really stands out to me is how short of a time they really are giving these prisoners in this jail. I presume that this is very similar across facilities, that the lights go out at 11 and breakfast begins as early as 4 a.m.
Yep.
And so that's only 5 hours of sleep. Most people are sleeping, you know, I'd imagine you're getting at least 6 to 7 hours at least, if not more. So there's a prisoner in this that describes how this deprivation actually led her to have a shorter temper and ended her up when she got in trouble. And now she's in solitary confinement conditions.
Yeah. Sure.
And no longer can she assist in her defense. So it very literally has driven this person mad to the point where they now are in worse confinement conditions.
I already like this judge. The judge described himself as very sleep deprivation sensitive. It says he was unimpressed with the county attorney's rationale for dead of night wake up calls. And he said, quote, "I do not see why people are poked and probed at 3 o'clock in the morning." He's exactly right. One of the things that used to drive me crazy, my prison was in central Pennsylvania, in the mountains of central Pennsylvania. The weather was terrible. It snowed all the time, it seems. And at 4 a.m., they used to make a prison-wide announcement. 4 a.m., attention in the institution, snow call. And so 5 or 6 guys out of 1,400 people whose job it was to shovel the snow had to wake up and get their shovels and go out and shovel the snow. There was no reason to wake up 1,425 people for that announcement, but they did that every single night that there was snow. And there's a lot of snow in the mountains of central Pennsylvania in the middle of the winter.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard to like hold back a laugh because a lot of this just sounds really ridiculous. Like I imagine the judge is talking to the defense attorneys or the people who are representing the prisons and the government and thinks it's quite ridiculous what they're claiming, because like, as you say, it just seems completely preposterous that you would have to wake up everyone. If you only need 4 individuals, why don't you send an officer or guard to their cell and tell them that, hey, we need you to go shovel. That's your job or whatever. Like you don't need to wake up the whole prison.
No.
So I think, and also just to add this one point before we would move on, that apparently there's a larger lawsuit on behalf of women inmates in this county deals with abuses that are outside of this. And so it looks like what the judge is going to recommend is that they take this and they put it into that larger lawsuit and they say, well, this thing against sleep deprivation, I really do think it goes to your larger claims of having your civil rights violated in prison.
Indeed. Let's move on to an interesting article that our friend and colleague Paul Wright published in Criminal Legal News magazine. When I read this last week, I was just fascinated by it. It was a $175,000 settlement to a guy, a protester, who was holding a sign. It was laced with profanity. It was an anti-police sign, and a cop tased him for it.
I mean, obviously, this is because the cop was upset that someone was coming at him as hard as, and this is the way cops are. I mean, to be quite honest, they would do this to everyone if they thought they could get away with it. I mean, they think the only time that cops really hold back and they do not engage in this kind of activity against people is when they know that someone's watching, and when they know that if they do attack a person for flipping them off, cursing at them, doing whatever they're doing to express their freedom of speech, you know, the only time that they really do hold back is when they know that they're going to get in trouble for it. And also, like at public protests, there's lots of cameras sometimes that'll stop them. But, you know, this is really the way that they want to deal with citizens who do this kind of thing. So it looks like a pretty nice chunk of change to get
for
being tased after the profanity-laced sign. And, you know, like that's, you know, I mean, honestly, like maybe I should go around baiting some more cops.
I know, right? It could be like a side business. This sign that the guy had was very to the point. It was F bad cops. And that's all it said. He was in Commerce City, Colorado. A cop walked up to him and started to try to provoke him. They first told him, pack it up and move on. And the guy said that he had a constitutional right to be there. It's freedom of speech. He was on public property. The cop asked for an ID. The guy refused to provide an ID because he said he hadn't committed any crime. And then the cop tried to arrest him. So as the cop is trying to arrest him, the cop takes a step toward the guy and the cop slips. Apparently, the ground was wet, his shoe was slick, and he slipped and fell. When he got up, he runs at the guy as if the guy made him fall. And the guy takes off. The cop fires a taser at him. It hits him in the arm, but because it was in his arm, it didn't complete the circuit. So he ran around with this taser barb stuck to his arm. And when people were asking the cop, here, why are you chasing him? He's under arrest. For what? For trespassing and disorderly conduct. It's not disorderly conduct. When he's in front of the building yelling, F everybody, that's not. It's public property, freedom of speech. Relax. He refused to give me his ID, which he's required to do. For why? So I can issue him citation for trespassing. It's not trespassing. The guy had literally not done anything wrong. He was within his rights doing everything that he was doing there. And then he got hit with this taser barb. The barb had to actually be surgically removed at a hospital. They couldn't get it out. So he had to undergo a surgery to take this thing out. And he argued successfully that this was excessive force. It was cruel and unusual punishment. He suffered, you know, mental anguish and all that stuff that people say in these lawsuits. And he won. The city ended up settling out of court and the guy went home with $175,000. So I think this is a lesson for all police officers in America that you have to know the law. And I'm sorry that I took the last word. I hate doing that, but we're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Castalla. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.